are ready.
Great.
Well, thanks. First, thank you very much for having us here.
It's very appreciated. So,
ooh.
Want to take? That's okay.
I can ignore that one.
No,
Rick.
That's not mine. Okay.
Today is the 20th of January, 2015. And this is the start of an interview with Dennis and Anne at Regenerative Roots, LLC, at their home at Jefferson. My name is Dadit Hidayat, and I'll be the interviewer. I'm a Public Humanities Fellow with Fair Share CSA Coalition and the Center for the Humanities, University of Wisconsin-Madison. With me also, Erica Jones, a staff member from Fair Share CSA Coalition. This interview is being done in connection with the documentation of the life story of community-supported agriculture farmers in Wisconsin. We'll mainly be talking about CSA farmers' recollection of their CSA practice in Wisconsin. That's the introduction. And may I have your introduction based on this?
My name is Anne Drafel, and I was born in 1984. Our farm name is Regenerative Roots, and I'm one of the co-owners in the farm, along with Dennis. Let's see. I started farming in 2007, working on other folks' farms for about 5 years before starting Regenerative Roots. Our first year farming was 2012. The approximate farm size when we started was probably about an acre. And now we're a little shy of 2 acres, so we haven't grown too much. Let's see, farming specialty. We primarily grow vegetables, a few ground fruits, but mostly vegetables, and don't have any animals at the moment. And our business mix is probably about 30 to 35% CSA, maybe 10% farmers market, and about 55 or 60% wholesale, kind of depending on the year. And this year we're shooting for 40 CSA members and 40 shares. And last year we had about 37.
Do you need me to repeat all that?
No. What can be different?
Sure. Well, my name is Dennis Fizer, and I was born in 1984. My farm that I own with Anne is Regenerative Roots. And I started farming a little after Anne did in 2008 and worked on a number of farms and met farming. And then we started our own farm in 2012.
Excellent. Did you grow up in Wisconsin, both of you?
I did.
I did not.
Oh. Where in Wisconsin were you?
I grew up in Neshota, which is close to Oconomowoc in Waukesha County. Okay. So about 40 minutes drive from where we are now, which is nice to still be close to family.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then when you say 5 years farming, that was part of it with family?
Nope. None of that was with family. I have farming in my family like a couple generations back, but not my direct family right now.
Okay.
Where did you grow up, Dennis?
I grew up in southwestern Ohio, in Cincinnati. And similarly have no real farming unless you go 3 generations back in my family. And my grandfather grew up on a farm when he was a little kid, but never did any. So he liked garden.
Okay.
Yeah.
How did you know about your grandparent having a farming activity, like after you are in this farming business?
No, well, so my grandfather had a garden and we grew up going to visit him. But when he was a small child, he grew up on a farm. Kind of a standard turn-of-the-century farmstead. A few pigs, a few chickens,
nice.
Plenty of row crops. And
how did you end up in Wisconsin?
I kind of meandered my way up here. I went to school in Chicago.
Okay.
And then during my last year in Chicago and after I graduated, I worked for a nonprofit, not unlike Fair Share, did a lot of local food advocacy, promoting local food generally, connecting people with CSAs, educating growers on how to grow for certain markets, and through that got to know a lot of farmers one-on-one, got to see them at the farmer's market on a pretty regular basis, and, you know, there was something about it that was kind of drew me in, and so I asked around at the farmer's market, you know, hey, do you want some help on your farm next year, and found one that worked out great. So that's when I moved to Wisconsin, and I've been here ever since.
Is that how you met Anne?
Not at that particular farm.
Yeah, not right away, but I think the next farm I went to, this was 2009, we both ended up at this same farm, and that's where we met.
What was the first farm?
Well, the first farm I worked at was Tomato Mountain Farm, which is in Brooklyn, south of Madison, about 40 minutes or so. And then we met at Kings Hill Farm, which is farther west, out near Mineral Point.
Cool. What was your first farm?
I worked at Jen Eyre Family Farm in Sun Prairie for two seasons. Learned a lot. Then met Dennis at Kings Hill, and then after that I worked at TP down in Evansville for a while. So it was great to be able to learn different systems at different farms and kind of see that variation. I mean, I feel like that allowed us to sort of be flexible in the systems that we designed for our own farm, having sort of various perspectives first.
I don't know many CSA farm, but what you said happened to be in CSA farm, TP, Kings Hill, right?
All of them.
All of them.
Mm-hmm.
Any particular?
And all of them certified organic, too.
Even more specific. Any particular reasons? What led to that particular farm that you work with?
I would say friends working there or having a connection to it and just sort of like within a social network knowing that that was a place to apply for a job. After graduating from college, I traveled with some of my friends, and so I really wanted to find a farm job, not an internship, not a, you know, I needed to get paid for it in order to save up to travel with friends. And Jen Eyre had that opportunity available. Mm-hmm. So that was nice to be able to, you know, start learning. And I thought it was just like, oh, I'm leaving to go travel in December and I need something that ends in December. Farming's perfect. And then I ended up really loving it. So that was a great experience in that way.
What was your education?
I went to UW-Madison and studied molecular biology. And the last couple of years, I sort of focused on soil science a bit. So there's definitely some direct connections to farming, but it was more through doing my thesis, my undergraduate thesis, and kind of studying soil science and prairie restoration. And I was like, wow, the field work of this is really fun, but the number crunching, you know, just that data analysis part didn't resonate with me. So here I am doing field work, 100% field work, you know, which is nice.
Okay.
Yeah.
Was the same reason with you, Dennis, too? Well, I guess I'm one of the your farm work in the past were also the CSA farms?
Primarily. The first farm I actually worked on, I didn't mention, I studied abroad in Germany during my junior year in college. And just for a month, their school calendar set up so you have 2 months off between semesters. So during those 2 months, I was able to travel, so I visited friends and just kind of traveled around. But I also spent a month working on a cattle farm outside of Berlin, and that was a really transformative experience. It was completely outside my comfort zone. It was unlike anything I'd ever done. It was this remarkably cold winter. Every day was, below zero Fahrenheit. And somehow I made it through and that really got me thinking, and the experience of being outside all day, working physically, even in adverse conditions. I mean, there's something really profound and joyful about that I did not find in other places that I worked. So I think that really got me thinking about, you know, this might be what I want to do. And I pursued that further once I was back in Chicago and then Wisconsin. But in terms of the kinds of farms, other than the farm in Germany, they've all been certified organic vegetable farms. The first farm I worked at, Tomato Mountain, did not have a CSA at the time. They've since added one. But when I was there, they focused on growing crops for value-added production. So it was a smaller set of crops that they processed into salsas and jams and that sort of thing. And I was kind of a combination field hand and sometimes assistant farm manager, and, you know, just kind of got to do everything, which I really liked.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell me your education? What was your major?
I majored in environmental studies at University of Chicago.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So somehow both of you have somewhat connection with this kind of work that you're doing, maybe indirectly. Well, I guess directly. Had you thought about doing this when you were back in college?
No. Not until the very end, when I had this job and I was interacting with farmers on a more regular basis. But prior to that, farming, I never entered my mind. It was never a consideration. It was never presented as an option. I didn't know anybody who was engaged in it. So I didn't really even have a framework or context for thinking about farming as a possible career. Isn't really the right word. I mean, it's more of a lifestyle, I think. But it is how I make my living and want to make my living. And so I just kind of followed my gut, and it didn't lead me too far astray.
Did you, are you interested in the animal farm? You're not doing any animals now, and you worked with cattle in the winter.
I did.
Is that something you miss? You seem like you liked it.
I did really enjoy it. It was a phenomenal experience. It was very humbling, both in the sense of how much work is required to pull it off, and also in the sense of sort of the ethical ramifications of raising animals for meat. That gave me a lot to think about, and there was definitely something about that I really enjoyed. And it's not something that I would close off from future consideration, but, and this is something that we might talk about later, one of the reasons we're at the place where we are is because we have this strong feeling that we should be able to make a living working relatively reasonable hours, because that's something that you can actually sustain over decades. You know, there's too many farmers who burn out physically and emotionally and mentally and all those things. Precisely because, at least in my mind, people take on too much. They try to do everything. They try to have a vegetable farm and animals and an orchard without adequate help. And so the hope is it would be great if there were more animals here. Julie, who's also here at the farm, has meat rabbits, pastured meat rabbits, and that's a great addition. And, you know, we help take care of them every now and then when she's away or whatnot. But if someone else wanted to come here and kind of spearhead a livestock operation, that's definitely something I'd be happy to participate in. Though it's not something I'm looking to add on top of the vegetable farm, which is plenty.
We raised broilers, so chickens for meat, are 2 years ago,
mm-hmm.
and just sort of the seasonality of that and overlapped with a pretty busy time on the vegetable farm. And so that did feel like too much, even though we enjoyed raising them, and it was nice to have that added product either for our CSA members or for ourselves. It just was kind of one of those things where it was like stepping back from that is...
Wasn't that during the drought then also?
No, okay. that was 2013 that okay. we tried that. Okay. And, you know, there's definitely a market for it. People were really receptive to them, but it was kind of one of those moments where it's like stepping back and analyzing our quality of life needs and whether that, you know, having that one more thing really was important, or if just focusing and becoming more efficient on the vegetable side of the production and then teaming with others, like Dana said, to kind of add those other elements to the full farm, is kind of the direction that we've decided to go since then. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You're referring about reasonable hours, and you also said about quality of life.
Yeah.
Can you explain more about that? How do you see that, your perspective?
I think that since we've started farming, that's been a big mm-hmm. driving force to just have those conversations about what we are looking for. Because, I mean, it's not a secret that farmers don't make a lot of money, but I feel like we are very rich in just our like lifestyle and being outside. I mean, there are a lot of elements about working on the farm that I totally love and wouldn't give up for anything. But I think it is easy enough to be, you know, enthusiastic about everything. Like, I'm enthusiastic about growing edible mushrooms and having pigs and having this and having that. And you go to Moses and these other conferences and, like, there's so many ideas. So I think that intentionally honing it down so we have time for ourselves and for, like, our romantic relationship and friends with others and just all of those things are things that I guess I see as a quality of life. And so honing in that prior to deciding to grow or expand has been really at the core of kind of our growth patterns for mm-hmm. the past couple of years.
Yeah, and I would add to that that you know, very rarely is it the case, I think, that a profession or a job is that someone enjoys is the reason they enjoy it. You know, there's things that they enjoy that the job gives them, and that's why they enjoy the job. So farming, you know, I'm not farming because I want to farm, per se. I'm farming because what farming is all of these things that I really want. I want to be physically active. I want to be outdoors. I want to be involved in growing food. I want to connect that to the community. I want to make it a social gathering space for people to come and share in that experience. And so because farming offers me all those things, it's kind of a no-brainer that this is what I'm doing. And also within the farm, you're constantly faced with a thousand decisions, but if you know why you're making decisions, they're really easy to make. Whereas if you don't know why you're making decisions, if you don't have a sense of what you're really after, what your guiding principles are, what your basic needs are, you know, it seems most likely you'll just constantly be putting out fires and kind of wandering aimlessly, not really working towards a particular goal. And quality of life is the goal. And that's really what it's all about. Right? You know, if what you're doing causes your life to be miserable, you really shouldn't be doing it. And so figuring out ways to make what you're doing into something that makes your life wonderful, I think is really what it's all about. So we've thought long and hard and spent a lot of time talking and thinking and planning about how do we make this farm more of that? You know, how do we make this a space where friends can come and help out and we can see them during the growing season where it's otherwise hard for us to get off of the farm? How do we structure what we're growing and where we're selling it in such a way that we can stay on top of it, and we have time. So even in the height of the growing season, we can take a day or a day and a half off every week from the farm. That's huge. That's absolutely huge. And some people don't need that much. They don't need that much time off. Or they have different sort of quality of life requirements. They're happy working 7 days a week, 10 or 11 or more hours each of those 7 days. And that's great. And that's not where we're coming from. And so seeing if we can make that work in a way that works for us. And so far we have, and feel very grateful for that.
Mm-hmm. Obviously, CS is not your major, because only you said 35%, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
Then you have 40 members shares.
Correct. Yeah, we started off thinking that we would do... we started off having a CSA. That was our primary business model during our first season, 2012. But we decided to expand in wholesale for a variety of reasons, one of which is that I don't want to be an expert at 50 different crops. Like, I enjoy growing 50 different crops for our small CSA network of people. But just as we decided to grow our farm slowly, it made more sense to focus on, five or six things that we grow well and kind of sell more of those. I guess the example I often give is like peas and beans. Like, I have no interest in growing more peas and beans and picking them than is enough for 40 households. it's a labor thing. Like, what is profitable and what can we do? Because being a small farm, most of our work is done by hand or, human powered. And so you really have to be smart about those sort of efficiencies of scale, I guess. And I also really enjoy having a small CSA because it allows me to kind of like in my head know and reference 40 people. Like, I feel like once I get beyond that, then I'm not remembering people or knowing them specifically. So that's just like, and I'm sure that ranges from farm to farm what that number is, that people feel comfortable and manageable. But that's been nice. And we only market locally. So rather than going into Madison, all of our CSA members are just within a small network. It takes about an hour for you to do your delivery, which is nice. That means that then you're home and able to plug into other things or whatever. So that's changed over time. And we've just decided that that's a rhythm that works better for us, is to focus more on that. But the CSA still is what's bringing kind of that connection to our community and all those elements and reasons why we did start having a CSA to begin with. So,
can you elaborate more on that having 40 shares is manageable to remember them? And you also said about connecting with community. Can you elaborate more on that? Like, why it is important for you to have number?
Talk about that? Or?
Sure. Yeah, back when I worked at FairShare, I had the opportunity to visit a whole host of farms that were members of the organization, and it was really great to connect with other growers, which is something that we as a community have a hard time doing because of the nature of what we're doing. We're busy, and even when we're not that busy, it's hard for us to get off of the farm. And I got to talk to a lot of growers about why they have the scale that they do, why they choose a certain size, and I found that there are a few farms that, in terms of size and level of mechanization, were very similar to what we're doing now. And 40 does seem like it's a certain threshold. Like, there's something that happens after 40 members. Either a combination of getting more mechanized, is something that you need to do if you're growing past that scale and already have other outlets, like wholesale. Like, if you're growing more than 2 acres, you really need to start thinking about having a tractor. And then having a tractor means changing how you space your beds and how you control weeds. And, you know, it changes everything about how you're doing things. So that's certainly the sort of, I wouldn't say hurdle because I don't think you necessarily need to go over it. But there is something about some extra energy required to go beyond that. And also just on a human level, I mean, there's only so many people you can know and connect with and interact with. And after 40, you know, it gets harder and harder to do that. And, you know, certainly we've both worked on farms that have hundreds of members. We've worked at Tipi, which I think now is up to 600 chairs or more, maybe closer to 7. And that's great, and that's fine, and, you know, it's a very mechanized farm. They're growing on 50 acres, and we're growing on 2. And everything that's good about being small is what we really pride ourselves on. You know, we have almost no mechanization. We have a small walk-behind tractor that we prep our beds with in the spring. And after that, it's all hand tools, hand power, people digging in the dirt. And, you know, that just feels really good to us. It also means really low overhead. We don't have a lot of expensive implements or machinery which require constant upkeep. You know, most, if something breaks, you're looking at $40 or $50 tops to replace a part for anything that we have. You know, so it's like, even if we somehow miraculously, tragically lost all of our tools, it wouldn't really set us back that far financially. And that, you know, whereas if you have a tractor and you're dependent on it and it breaks at a really inopportune time, not only are you on the hook for a lot of money to get it repaired, but you're also set, like, the whole farm is negatively affected. You couldn't get the transplants in on time. And you know, a lot of people are mechanized and have tractors and they make it work, and that's great. But it's also not what I'd like to do with my time. And so keeping it small is part of that.
What has been the most valuable aspect of that human aspect that you indicated? Having a small number and getting to know them, can you bring us through all this experience, Jordan?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how unique it is to our farm being a small farm versus farms that have hundreds of shares. But I definitely feel like the connection that we have with our members is quite strong and has gotten a lot stronger every year. We were, you know, totally new to the area, new to having a CSA. We didn't have name recognition when we moved here. There aren't a lot of CSAs serving this area. And, you know, the first year or two, we had pretty high turnovers. There were a lot of people who were just trying it out for the first time, decide they don't like it. But now that we're entering, you know, having done this for 3 seasons now and entering our 4th season and our 3rd season on this farm in particular, you know, everybody's coming back, and they're coming back really quickly, and they're coming back with excitement, and they're really looking forward to the season. And you know, we're already almost full for our CSA, and we've done relatively little in the way of marketing compared to our first, our first years. We were, like, putting up flyers everywhere, trying to connect with as many people and places as possible. Mm-hmm. And this year, we've been able to coast a little more on established connections and established reputation. And so I feel like, hopefully that just continues and we just become the farm for these households. I mean, we have a few households who've been with us since the first year, and every year there's more and more of those who've been with us for several years, and that just feels really good.
So how did you start this? Like, when you, what made you decide I need to own my own farm. Both of them be a collective decision too.
I think you can learn a lot from working with other people, and that was a great experience. But I feel like you learn the most from really digging in and, you know, kind of being the one calling all the shots. Which wasn't the drive necessarily. I would say sort of the creative freedom and being able to design, you know, kind of design on your lifestyle or that quality of life for me was big. And so I love, you know, all the planning and then also the growing, and it, it feels really good to sort of have, our own farm and, be able to have, you know, have that reflect our values and sort of our quality of life needs and those sort of things.
What values would you say, like, do you see the most, like, living out here on the farm?
Part of it is living out here on the farm. there's no
true.
Denying that. I mean, we've both lived in cities. I lived in Chicago for 6 years. I grew up in a city. You know, Cincinnati's about the same size as Madison, population-wise. And I think Kings Hill, which was my second year of farming, was really when it hit me that I wanted to be out in the country. And, you know, I lived out in the country when I worked there. And that was really great. And it was important to me to not be commuting a lot. I've driven a lot for farms, you know, when I worked at both Tomato Mountain and Kings Hill. It was regularly commuting to Chicago for deliveries or farmers markets. And I'd be on the road 3 hours each way, once or twice a week. And, you know, so I've done that, and I can do that, and I really don't want to do that if I don't have to. So really being very physically close to the people that we are growing food for is important. Our CSA is very local. We only do Fort Atkinson, Jefferson, and Whitewater, so all within 20 minutes. And like Ann mentioned earlier, I can load up the car and I'll be pulling back into the driveway an hour later, which is great. So that's really important. I think the creative freedom is huge, though, you know, it's not like I couldn't get that working at another farm necessarily, but I did feel like, one, the farms that I worked on were larger and mechanized, and that was not something I particularly enjoyed. The mechanization, not something I particularly enjoyed, but especially the larger farms. I didn't enjoy not being connected to the full cycle of any given crop. You know, I might transplant bok choy, and then I might see it again when I harvest it. There's not really a regular active connection to each of those things because there's so much that you're just plugging in wherever it makes sense to plug in. And I really wanted more of an experience where I could be more intimately connected to the whole seasonal cycle of every single crop and plant on the farm. And 2 acres does allow you to do that. Every week we do a field walk. We go through everything and we look at it and we say, you know, this is what this week is going to look like. This is what we're going to do on these days. And being able to really have that and see that is huge. That really means a lot.
I think another value that I'd like to plug in is also just sort of being less reliant on fossil fuels. That's been a big driving force, just sort of for long-term sustainability and not wanting to smell diesel fumes all the time. You know, sort of just that environmental, my own, you know, personal environment. So I would say that's a value that I kind of see at the core, is trying to reduce those needs. I mean, of course, when we are delivering vegetables into Madison for wholesale, like, it's not like we're a fossil fuel free farm, but I think we try to reduce that usage as much as possible. And, you know, but you're replacing that with human labor or, you know, other techniques that sometimes are, you know, more time consuming for sure.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like it was an easy decision for you. It's very natural considering that you work with multiple farms and you learn about farming from those farms. It's easy decision relatively to own your own.
In theory.
Or logical decision, I guess I would say.
Yeah, I mean, I think it made sense for us, but then the actual act of finding land and, like, deciding to go full in. Our first season we farmed in Whitewater, and that was an incredible experience because we were renting a land that had already been a CSA farm in the past. So there was a greenhouse, there was a hoop house, there was a walk-in cooler, all these things we were able to rent. And that was a great find, because I think the hardest thing about young farmers wanting to, like, hey, we want a farm, and getting up and going, is finding land that's, you know, maybe can be certified organic because it's, you know, already sustainably stewarded. But also, you know, just having that opportunity to rent before going full in. And after that year, we decided that we did want to go full in. But we also decided that we wanted to make some pretty major changes, which, like, that year was very, well, it was the drought. It was 2012. So it was a hard season to start in, but it also was really isolating. And that was, like, the core of our decisions to go forward, is, like, if we're going to continue having our own farm, it has to be in the context of more of a community and more of a social network, which is what we're trying to create here, is sort of, a cooperative of different farm entities and different people connected to the land. So it's not as isolating, and that just takes time. I mean, moving to a new area and getting to know people is something that takes time. But I think that first season was a really good realization, and sort of that process of, you know, quality of life and all those things we've been talking about, is just saying, like, if we're going to do this, these are the, you know, things that are required in order for us to actually want to go forward. Mm-hmm.
How did you go about, I guess, like, well, finding this place eventually, but also, like, the process by which you set up your entity, which I know maybe you could talk a little bit more about that, but just kind of how did you kind of go through that? Because you wanted to go all in, and, yeah. How did you get there?
I mean, we lucked out.
Yeah.
I mean, that's, there's always an element of luck, I feel like, in these sorts of things, you know, stumbling across the right people at the right time, and that's definitely what happened here. The former landowners of this farm where we are now, we just kind of connected with them at the right time. They were talking about forming more of a land-based community here, interested in having people rent some of the acreage and manage it in sort of a food production system sort of way. And, you know, there were a lot of people involved in the very early discussions, just brainstorming and talking about ideas. And we actively pursued it. We're like, this is great. This is exactly what we want. And, you know, it took a couple of years of a lot of meetings and a lot of talking and hashing out compromises and agreements so that everybody felt, you know, emotionally invested in the project to the point where we are now, which is where we do have an entity made up of currently 7 people who all jointly own the land, and we collectively kind of make decisions about managing the land, though, you know, our farm is an independent entity unto itself. Mm-hmm. You know, we as a group say, hey, it's great to have a vegetable CSA farm here. And then the vegetable CSA farm decides how it wants to farm and, you know, checks in saying, hey, we're going to be growing on a couple acres. This is how we're going to be doing it. We'll have some people over a couple times a year for events, you know, those sorts of things. Very general, big picture. But, you know, both sharing a house and a piece of land with other people is huge. You know, it's what we want. We've both lived in various forms of community for a number of years and really enjoyed that and taken to it as our preferred way of living. You know, I lived at housing co-ops in Chicago and Madison and in Madison, and mm-hmm. you know, it just felt really natural and fulfilling, and trying to recreate that in what otherwise is typically a pretty, you know, go it alone and potentially isolating endeavor, you know, where, yeah, you have neighbors and you have town and you have farmers market where you see people every week, but it's really not the same as sharing meals and helping each other with projects and just generally taking care of a piece of land. I mean, it's a lot. It's a lot to take care of a house and land and buildings, and I, you know, don't have any real desire to take that on myself. I'd much rather share that with other people.
Mm-hmm. And that's quite unique, mm-hmm. very unique yeah. compared to other farms, right?
I think so, but I also think with the cost of land, I mean, it's just, it's the only way that it really works, you know, to be, if you want to be an owner. You know, I think a lot of farms just rent forever, and that works for some people. But I feel like wanting to invest in perennials and just sort of a long-term plan for a place is hard if you're renting. So I hope that what we're doing is a model that other folks can take on and say, you know, like, having a, you know, $4,000 or $400,000 mortgage and running a small farm, like, they don't really match up very well. Whereas if you collectively join in with other people, you get A, the community, but B, also some of that financial, you know, you're sharing both the risks and rewards of whatever's happening there. So, mm-hmm. I don't know, another member of our kind of cooperative group has kind of dubbed it like community-owned agriculture, like rather than community-supported agriculture. Mm-hmm. And I think when he first brought that up, you know, that really resonated, where it was like, I mean, it's more of an investment in a place and in sort of the long haul of a piece of land.
Mm-hmm. And I think it goes back to, you know, we were talking about guiding principles and making decisions, and, you know, we were very clear on what the guiding principles were. And, you know, sticking to those, it's important not to get attached to particular outcomes. It's important to be able to look at an outcome and say, is this going to, you know, aren't my guiding principles pointing me in this direction? And so, like, it is very unique and unorthodox, and there are a lot more people interested in forming some sort of cooperative farm entity, whether it's worker-owned cooperatives or land cooperatives or land trusts, you know, these sorts of things. There's been a big uptick in interest. Mm-hmm. And I think that's because a lot of people are thinking the same things and saying, you know, these are things that I want, and it's pointing me this way. It's pointing me towards an option that both allows, you know, me as a farmer to be connected to a piece of land with long-term land security without taking on, you know, absurd amounts of debt, which, you know, really puts kind of a chokehold on how you farm. You know, if you have a lot of debt, that debt is going to say you have to farm this way, because you have to make the money to pay off this debt. And so, you know, crafting a unique but workable solution allows us to, you know, remain debt-free, own a piece of land, work with other people, be in community, you know, all those things that we want. And so, you know, it is a decision that, you know, kind of like farming was never really an option in my mind until I was exposed to people who are actively involved with it. It's important not to get stuck only, you know, with a limited set of options. It's okay to write your own option, you know, like fill in the blank, create whatever it is that feels right and makes sense. And that may not be the right thing for almost everybody else, but that's not important. It's the right thing for you, and
yeah.
And you know, there's no reason to deny yourself that sort of agency. There's no reason to like settle for something that doesn't work for you. You know, certainly there's times where it makes sense, like make sacrifices towards a greater goal, but I think, you know, that's kind of a different thing. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I feel like it's unique, but it feels right and it makes sense.
You have a few things here, like being an unorthodox, like young. CSA is less organic itself. It's also mm-hmm. not very common. still small mm-hmm. group of them. Your business model is also another uncommon. So how do people respond to this unique models that you bring? Friends, families, how do they respond in your initial?
I think it's great.
Yeah, I would say, I mean, I think the bottom line is that our friends and family see that we're, like, happy and really enjoying life. So, like, mm-hmm. you know, they're curious about it. People who are interested ask more. Other people just, you know, see us as a vegetable farm. You know, like, I feel like there's a range mm-hmm. in our reputation. So, you know, even though we've been working on this process of cooperatively purchasing this property for the past 2+ years, I wouldn't say that it's really been a big part of our like marketing story yet, because we didn't own it until last November. And so there was always the possibility that it would all like fall apart. And, you know, like, so we didn't want to really push that as the core identity. But I think people think it's interesting. So I would say, you know, we put it out there, but and the people who see it and resonate with it ask more questions, and other people mm-hmm. just buy produce from us at farmers market. And, you know, any way that people want to plug in along that spectrum, we're open to talking about and hanging out with. But my family's been really receptive, and mm-hmm. I really appreciate that, because it is pretty unorthodox.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that the group of people for whom we are the most unorthodox are our neighbors. you know, I mean, we live in this rural community, and everybody grows corn and soybeans, and nobody is organic, and that's kind of like most places, right? Mm-hmm. And what most people are doing. So, you know, at first, for them to see, one, us just doing 2 acres, which is a ridiculously small amount of land for any kind of row crop production, you know, they're growing on hundreds or thousands, all completely mechanized. And, you know, not only growing vegetables, but growing this wide array of vegetables. I mean, 50 or 60 different kinds of things, some of which they may never have seen before. And then also being certified organic, yeah, that, you know, that is another level, but it's like we don't judge them for being conventional row crop farmers, and they don't judge us. I mean, they think we're weird, but it's true. <We are. laughs> you know, they don't judge us negatively. So, I mean, it's been a pretty positive experience, and it's all about just connecting with your fellow human beings. And I think we've been pretty successful in being able to do that. You know, because if there is one thing that I think our community of neighbors really does respect kind of universally is hard work. And they see we're working hard. They may think we're crazy. I mean, they do think we're crazy. There's no doubt about it. They told us to our faces. But, but you know, they're very amicable and curious. You know, we hire out primary tillage when we need a field worked up because we don't have a tractor and plow and stuff that we would use. So we hire it out, and, you know, there's a conventional dairy farmer down the road who comes and does it with his small equipment, which is still huge. And he's a great guy, you know, and he's always asking questions about where we're selling, how we market, you know, what sort of growing practices we use. Because it's just an alien concept. He doesn't know any organic vegetable farmers. He doesn't know anything about how you go about growing vegetables organically. And so we just answer the questions and have good conversations. And, so, you know, and I feel like that's been a really good experience to feel like we don't just connect with people inside of our ideological bubble of organic vegetable farmers, you know, but really just with our community, you know, the people who live next door and can see what we're up to.
Has it presented any challenges? And what are those challenges and how have you addressed them?
The only real challenge, I would say, you know, there's part of the farm that has a thistle problem. And neighbors are not too keen on thistles going to seed. You know, but, you know, it's kind of the fundamental aspect of it is just maintaining your land in a way that is not causing problems for other people, either because it's unsightly or because it's going to blow a bazillion thistle seeds into their pastures or cornfields or whatever. And so, yeah, it's just responding to those things. And, you know, if something comes up, it's you do due diligence as a good neighbor to get on top of it.
Can you give an example?
Well, I mean, the thistles, I think, those are the only real issue that we've had. And it was kind of during an awkward transition period with the land ownership and not having the equipment to take care of it. But since then, we've kind of figured out.
This year, the bunnies took care of it.
The bunnies took care of it.
They ate all the thistles.
Ate it right down.
Pretty impressive. Well, we did mow quite a bit in the spring.
We did, yeah.
But I'm amazed at what those little fuzzy things can eat.
Have your neighbors' activities impacted your land? I guess I don't know where your land goes to, if it's well protected or...
It has not, thankfully. I mean, the one thing that there is some concern about is spray. Because we adjoin conventional cornfields and everybody sprays. And, you know, but so far what I've seen over a couple of years is that people are doing it responsibly. They're spraying when there's not a lot of wind. They're keeping the sprayers very close to the ground so it's not, you know, drifting all over the place. You know, so that's something. And like I said, our neighbors know that we're certified organic and that we're growing vegetables, and they know that what they're spraying kills everything except for
corn.
What they're growing.
And it's just an investment of their part. You know, they don't want all of their spray to be blowing away because then they have to buy more, you know. So it's like, even if it's a more...
So it hasn't been a problem.
Yeah.
But, you know, I do just worry about it, like, oh, is the wind going to shift, right? You know, or just something unpredictable going to happen. But so far it's not been a problem.
Yeah.
So knowing that they are considerate as well with your practice, it's satisfying for you, I mean, rewarding experience.
Yeah, definitely.
I mean, I would certainly love to have more tree lines or more, you know, like, I think that there are things that we can do on our property, too, to mitigate some of those risks a little more. And now that, you know, we're co-owners and kind of can come up with a longer-term management system for the land, like, I'm sure those sort of things will be talked about and considered.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we'd like more trees on the property anyways. But, you know, are you going to go planting them if you're not sure if you're going to buy it? And if you sell that, it means someone for sure is going to plant it in the corn. So, Not worth putting in trees.
So basically you learn all this stuff by doing, because your education didn't really provide you with this all technicality, but you learn by doing based on mm-hmm. your work.
Yeah, and I would say that after graduating from college and working at John Deere Family Farm is where I learned that I actually do learn by doing. You know, like, I don't feel like our typical education system, like, I was always a really good student, but I never knew that I was sort of a hands-on or kinesthetic learner until, you know, I was 22 or whatever age I started farming at. So that's been interesting. I think there are, you know, elements of sort of soil health and knowing what's going on with, you know, minerals that are positive ions or negative ions. Like, some of the science part of it, I think my education does help me to see in a different light that maybe other farmers who weren't trained in that way don't. But I feel like I always knew that I was sort of a big picture thinker and a bigger systems thinker, and I feel like a lot of academia kind of hones in on a very, very, very specific thing rather than looking at the broader picture. So that was something that always frustrated me. So I think that's part of why farming really resonated, because it's like, it's very hands-on, and it's also sort of like you're working on tiny little details, but it's all part of a bigger system. Yeah.
So if you were to ask, what is CSA from your perspective now that you also mentioned earlier, community-owned agriculture, but with your own words, what is community-supported agriculture means for you?
I mean, I think it's a lot of things. I think primarily, though, it is a mentality. I think it's a personal philosophy. Not necessarily my own personal philosophy, but that other people have that says, this is something that's really important. Local, organic production of food is a really important thing, and I'm going to support that with the lifestyle choices I make, whether it's actually joining a CSA and getting a share, or coming to the farmer's market, or, you know, coming to a benefit dinner, or something like that. I think, you know, it's all about people saying that this is something that I value, and I want to see it persist and expand and become more part of, you know, everyday life. That, to me, is huge. You know, and we as a farmer, we do a lot of wholesale, but it's, you know, to a local co-op, and it still feels very direct to the people that are eating the food. And, you know, so I think that's the crux of it. I don't think it's merely a checkbox on a brochure and you get a box every week with some recipes and a newsletter. I think it's a lot more than that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And when
I think that what we call a CSA share should actually be called something different. Because I think that the term community supported agriculture is that bigger system that Dennis was describing that includes, you know, like really robust farmers markets and, you know, maybe a local food co-op that supports farmers and all these, and maybe a subscription share. Like, that is all community supported agriculture for me. So the fact that CSA is a name for, you know, this very particular model, I don't think we'll be able to change that into a different phrase, but that sort of frustrates me because I think that's a little confusing to people and to me. But I think the people who make the most of a CSA share, and what I mean by that is, you know, coming to farm events and that kind of stuff, like, and really getting to know us and our community, like, that's huge, and that sort of is what I hope CSA can be for people who are connected to our farm. Because there's nothing better than, like, seeing a little kid, like, pull a carrot out of the ground and, like, wipe it on their pants and eat it. Like, that's very real, and that allows them to see where their food comes from, you know, like, and probably enjoy eating carrots a lot more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think too, I mean, you know, our CSA traditionally understood, you know, a weekly box of produce. We're distributing them very locally to people that we do see on a regular basis, whether we're just in town running errands or going to the farmer's market. And, you know, it's like, these are the people we want to hang out with in our free time. You know, it's like meet up at the bar for a drink or something. You know, it's a very real social community. It's not just a financial transaction and a sign-up form, and we may never see them. And, you know, and that was another big decision in staying small. And, you know, we don't sell CSA shares to Madison because we're not there. I mean, we sell wholesale because it's a great market for it, but really, as long as we are in this area, we want to be providing the food for the people that we see every day.
Yeah, I guess we can start that with, like, telling more about how, what inspired you with collective life, basically. Like, you said a lot about community, and now even after I learned how you plan your holiday, it's like, how did you come to that idea of live collectively?
I lived in a housing co-op in college, and it was really awesome. But it felt like too many people in too small of a house and too small, not too small of a city, but just like a lot. So I think enjoying elements of that, but knowing I wanted to live out in the country, kind of combining elements from that into my farm life seemed like a natural thing to at least attempt to create, and we have, you know, successfully created. I mean, you know, in the city we are living with 10 other people. Right now we're living with one other person. Like, there's definitely a different dynamic to it. But I don't know. I would say that a lot of it is wanting to support our relationship, because sort of that element of having other people around, it is what helps to support it. You know, to rely on one another as, like, romantic partners and business partners and, you know, try to manage an entire property together and have, you know, debt and financial obligations and all. Like, that just seems very, very heavy. And I don't, you know, I feel like we have a very strong relationship, but I don't know if it could withstand all of that. So kind of, you know, collective decision making, or like going on vacation. Like, I'm sure we would love going on vacation together, but we also hang out together all the time. So why not invite, you know, friends and go with other people? We can still, you know, have one-on-one time while we're there when we choose to, but having that option to have somebody else around to interact with is pretty, like, liberating too. So
yeah, I mean very broadly, working at other farms taught us a lot about how to run a good farm. You know, this is how you grow for wholesale. This is how you run a CSA logistically, or plan your crops. You know, there are also plenty of things that we learned not to do. and one of those is, is just what Anne was talking about, is, you know, becoming, you know, too overly dependent on each other for support when you're living together and running a farm together. Because we've definitely seen relationships struggle and crumble under that weight. I mean, it's not an abstract concept or an irrational fear. Like, we've seen it happen, and it's been really sad and unfortunate. And thinking about, you know, well, why was that? And obviously there's always a million reasons, but one of the big ones is just the constant, unrelenting stress of being together all the time. And, you know, I think a strong relationship depends on each person having a rich life of their own. And when you're farming, it's hard enough to get off the farm, period. So, you know, I think that those sorts of things are really big considerations for us.
Mm-hmm. Do you have off-farm work still, or...?
I work part-time... excuse me. I work part-time in the winter, just a couple days a week for a couple months. It's been kind of a moonlighting sort of gig, working at the co-op in Madison, Lily Street Co-op. And it's great because it is a big part of my network of friends. So I get to see and interact with my friends on a regular basis. It also is physical activity in the winter. It also is handling vegetables in the winter, you know, which is something that I really miss. So that's really enjoyable. Though, you know, for purposes of making a living, we do rely entirely on the farm.
Mm-hmm. I've waitressed in a few different places during the winter, and I've really enjoyed that because I think they've always been farm-to-table restaurants, so it's exciting to sort of see that other end and to, you know, have more of a story to say, hey, I grew those carrots or whatever. This winter I am not, you know, just the timing and the labor needs of the place that I was working haven't really played out yet, so I've just been doing a lot of yoga. I feel like I've had a pretty posh winter. It's been great. But our first season, 2012, I did waitress a few nights a week and farm, and that was just too much for me personally to be able to handle. I have a lot of respect for people who do farm and also work off-farm during the farm season, but it just left my brain too scattered. So I think finding something to kind of plug in the months where it's a little slower is something that I find manageable and enjoy for the same sort of social reasons that Dennis has talked about, but I would say we focus more on paring down our personal budget and our personal like living needs financially. So then with that number lower, kind of the work hours or whatever that need to go into that to making, you know, the whole system work can be a little more flexible.
Mm-hmm. What has been the most memorable moment?
I mean, I think not a moment, but this past season, the choice to hire an employee changed our world. It was amazing. I mean, we've had, you know, a few friends come out and help every now and then, kind of irregularly, which was good and fun and, you know, definitely helped us get through some of the big pushes of the season. But I remember a couple friends came over fall of 2013 to press cider. We have a couple apple trees. And so they brought a press and they just went to town. And it was August or something. They're pretty early apples. And later, I think that winter, they were telling us about this day, and their impression of us was that we were just, like, dog tired. You know, looked so exhausted. And we felt pretty much that way. You know, just really in the height of tomato season, and everything is going full tilt. And, you know, they're like, should we go and help them? They look like they could really use a hand. But they continued to press cider, which I'm glad, it was good cider. But, you know, then hiring an employee, like, it was a big shift in terms of how we manage our farm. But it was so great. It was so good. We lucked out. We had an employee with kind of an unusual schedule, and we imposed the unusual schedule.
But it worked for her.
But it worked out great for her, and she was an awesome person that, you know, we got along with really well. So, I mean, it just really transformed the whole experience of the farm. And, you know, so if there's one thing that I think stands out a lot is making that decision. And, you know, it feels good, too. It feels good to both be making a living, modest though it may be, from the farm, but also be able to pay somebody, at least something, above minimum wage, to work. And it really felt like we might be doing something right if we can pull that off. So that was really edifying, I think.
Do you have work shift? Sorry.
Oh. I was like, when you first asked that question, I was like, I can't remember a moment. Then I was like, oh yeah, I remember a moment. I would say the moment our first season when we realized that you don't actually need to grow 200 Sun Gold cherry tomato plants for a CSA of 20 people. That like, it should actually be one to 10 ratio in the opposite direction. But the moment that goes along with that was sort of being this, we were certified organic our first season. So I think that's something that's fairly unique about startup farms. But it's just something that we were passionate about. So we were certified organic and we said we should call Willie Street Co-op and see if they want to buy them. And then the moment when they said, yes, they do, we were like, whoa. And from that.
Now we have to pick.
So, and we've definitely gotten more efficient in our processes since that first year. But, I think kind of that we did a CSA planning course that was held at Michael Fields. Mm-hmm. I would say a year or two before starting our own farm. And, Richard Wiswall, who wrote the Organic Farmer's Business Handbook, mm-hmm. said something. He spoke there one of the first days, and he said, you know, like, the worst they can say is no. And so I feel like that's something that, like, in life is hard. You know, like, rejection is hard, and being vulnerable in that way is hard. But as a business, I was like, yeah, we might as well just call, and the worst they can say is no. And, like, mm-hmm. whatever, no is just no. So that was nice to kind of feel like, I don't know, it was intimidating, but then when they said yes, I was like, oh. And now, you know, that's basically the core of our 60% of our business is doing wholesale with them. So, mm-hmm. you know, little moments like that can really kind of alter the future of your business if yeah. you are flexible and invite them, I would say.
Mm-hmm. I was going to ask, where kind of do you, so you have an employee now, mm-hmm. what are like the next steps? Where do you kind of see things going? Do you have?
Not really anywhere different.
Yeah.
I mean, and that's the nice thing. I think like that's what I was getting at, that feeling of having an employee, like, this is so great. I don't need to change anything. Just, you know, like there's nothing about this that I would change or think I could significantly improve. And so at least for the time being, you know, 2 acres is good. Our CSA wholesale farmers market balance is good. Our labor is good. You know, the hours that we have to work is good. You know, a few tweaks. And that's how we've wanted to farm and how we are farming, is not trying to grow our way to success, but kind of perfecting our way to success. Yeah. Just taking what we do well and making it a little better. And, you know, selling more and spending less is the same as, you know, you can run that equation a whole bunch of different ways. You can spend more and sell a lot more, or you can just spend less and sell the same amount. You know, but we would like to spend less for sure. That's kind of our primary financial plan. Spend less. And, you know, sell a little more. Do a little better each year. You know, change just little things. Tweak.
I think it's much easier to improve upon a system that you already have existing than to like keep growing and growing and growing and growing each year and have to redesign new systems every single year for those changes. So that was the difference that we really observed between this previous year and the year before, because we stayed the same size, and like last year seemed so much easier, you know, because you're just like perfecting on ideas or systems that you already had, you know, at least started developing that year before. So I feel like that's been huge, to feel like we're working less but making more money, and that feels like a good direction to be going in.
Yeah, and I think also, you know, we haven't had a bad year. We have not had that catastrophic year that I know we'll have sometime. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, like, we're at a spot where it seems like, you know, looking at the numbers and looking at our field plan and sales expectations, like, we could have a catastrophic year and still be okay. You know, we wouldn't be making any big purchases. But we'd turn out okay. So that feeling is this huge sense of relief, you know, to accept that there's going to be a horrible, terrible, very bad year.
Sounds like that book.
That book.
That book. And then, terrible, horrible. Yeah.
No good, very bad day.
No good, very bad day.
But year.
Love
year,
that book. Yeah. But just a whole year, just relentless. Floods in the spring, and late blight in the summer, and then an early frost in August or something. You know, just like, I could really do a number. Just might as well.
Don't say it aloud.
But, you know, to feel like we'd come through okay. That's big.
Yeah.
You said earlier that your CSA is a bit different than how people traditionally understand about CSA. Am I accurate?
Our understanding of CSA is different.
Yeah.
I mean, how we run our CSA
is pretty similar to
just like everyone else.
But then how do you see yourself in a big idea of CSA as part of this local food movement?
Mm-hmm.
I would say I see the way that we're making it viable, maybe, as the unique thing that we can add to that. And what I mean by that is just being like young farmers with a different story of land access and more of that sort of collective or cooperative making a go at it. So our CSA is only one element in that bigger picture of what we're doing, but I think that bigger picture is why we're able to be profitable and viable as a CSA, or, you know, just as a small farm in general.
Can you also mention, now I can see that your story is really about just making sure that you have a good life. It doesn't matter. It just happens that farming can be your tool, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if farming ceased to provide all of those elements of a good life, then we would cease farming.
Right.
And hopefully not regret that too much.
Still guard.
Huh?
Still garden.
Oh, yeah. Still garden. No, that's hard. It's hard not to plant 500 tomatoes. Just two.
What do you put in the rest of the flat?
Yeah, really.
You mentioned you will not, at least at this point, you don't consider growing, but you just want to make sure that you can perfecting. Can you elaborate?
Perfecting
more about,
might be
that's a strong word.
A strong word.
Good enough is perfect.
That's a good farm motto.
That is our motto.
Luckily, our definition of good enough is a pretty high standard.
Yeah,
high enough standard to give a good product. But I think farming has taught me one thing about not being a perfectionist, because I feel like in, you know, growing up, and I always kind of identified myself as that. But that last, like, 10%, you know, going from 90% to 100% takes just, like, that last 10% takes the same amount of time as the first 90%, I guess, is something that I think about. So sort of letting go and not having to be perfect and acknowledging that I'm not in control, like, that's actually been a huge sort of philosophical and lifestyle shift for me. So farming has helped me to not become a perfectionist, hence the good enough is perfect theme. Because, you know, pushing everything to be exactly perfect and defining what you see as perfect is limiting. Mm-hmm. For sure.
So knowing that this is your social life, basically you, if I ask what you have sacrificed, maybe nothing really. It's nothing that you sacrifice to do this because this is your life.
Right? I mean, I think yeah. we're still trying to recalibrate our social life mm-hmm. after living in the city. Mm-hmm. You know, living in a city makes it so easy to just see people spontaneously or with very little notice or planning. So, you know, that's definitely something that we miss. And it's been slow going, kind of finding patterns and rhythms and just like, hey, every Wednesday, you know, we'll meet up at this place for whatever. And, you know, we are slowly finding those things and that is happening. It's just a matter of patience. I mean, because I don't doubt that we'll get to a point where that feels like it's good enough to. but, you know, we are still working on that. Mm-hmm. But other than that, I would say that, I mean, there's no regrets regardless, because I feel like the trade-offs have been so great. You know, we've been able to fulfill all of these needs that we couldn't before. You know, it's like a few years of struggling socially is more than worth it, because we can work on that too. You know, and having this foundation is far more important for the here and now. Mm-hmm.
How many hours do you typically work per day for on the field?
I don't even know if this is fair to say for...
I feel embarrassed. I mean, I would say, you know, peak season, 50 hours?
45, 50,
something
yeah.
Something like that.
Each. And how many hours is your worker?
24.
Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Which, you know, really forced us to make those 3 days, you know, as efficient as possible. So planning a schedule to give to somebody else also allowed us to schedule our week better. And so, like, right now, Monday, the only thing we do on Mondays is do our field walk. Other than that, like, it's a total free day. And that was huge for me to have some time to get off of the farm. And then after farmers markets on Saturday afternoons. Usually are pretty chill, mm-hmm. but having that scheduled and having that kind of be non-negotiable was something that was different last year and felt like a huge, it was huge. I mean, just to mm-hmm. kind of have that renewed excitement every week about what's going on and feeling on top of things and therefore being able to step away from them.
Yeah. And not feeling burned out. I mean, going into October, November, just like, that was good. Yeah, I'm feeling good. Instead of like, oh my gosh, somebody help me. Because I've been there too. It's like, oh, I can't believe I made it. You're just like counting the days and the weeks until the season is over, just like waiting for frost so you can just stop.
and
just be done. But... yeah, I mean, I think last year that was huge, just having that kind of mental energy to, the time to recharge.
And the time to cook with our own food. Like, that's huge, too, because we have all this beautiful produce in the middle of the season, so if you don't have time to cook lunch or to cook dinner and share those meals, like, what's the point? It's all about eating, right? So that felt good.
Mm-hmm.
Canning, that takes too much time.
But. You just freeze everything. Throw it in a bag, call it done.
How many workers do you have?
Just one.
Just one?
Yeah, mm-hmm.
part-time. 24 hours a week.
Yeah.
And so this is an employee as opposed to a work share.
Yeah, we do have some volunteers that regularly come out, and hopefully will again this coming year.
Mm-hmm.
And that wasn't for a CSA box in exchange. It was more for like seconds or just farm extras and stuff. So a little more, I would say it's a bit more flexible than other mm-hmm. farms, like worker share programs.
Yeah, they're just our friends and they want to spend some time on a farm and they'd rather spend time on our farm.
But some of them have become friends because they've been here. You know, it's not that there are some people that we've mm-hmm. met and got to know really well through that process.
But yeah, it's not very structured. We don't expect them to come, and they can take home second vegetables, but it's like whatever we have is what we have.
Mm-hmm.
So it works out well.
And some people like that flexibility more than feeling like they have to take a whole share and mm-hmm. they won't eat it or they don't like this or they don't like that. So it's worked for us.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we're hesitant to do a worker share program, having heard stories from other farmers who have worker share programs. You know, it's like it's really hard to rely on people to come out every week, especially you know, if they're coming from farther away, mm-hmm. and we just don't want to deal with that. We want to like have low expectations and have people exceed those low expectations.
I don't know. My mom says that we're pretty picky about.
We are picky our about volunteer. Who gets to volunteer. It's true.
Most rigorous volunteer application process ever.
No, we want to have a good time. We don't want to hang out with people who are. You bring a negative attitude or not working or those sorts of things. Or, you know, who would require so much supervision that it takes away from what we get done because we could do it faster on our own than spending our time teaching them how to do it less fast. But it's worked out just fine.
How do you judge excellence in your CSA? Or I guess.
Good enough. I mean, you know, we do.
Maybe it does help that I'm still a bit of a perfectionist. Good enough.
I mean, there's certain things that I think you can't. You know, CSA especially. You know, designing a share and CSA events on the farm. You can't hope for perfection because there is no such thing. No, you will never, ever please everybody. Ever. You know, with any particular crop, you know, it's like tomatoes. Some people think it's too many tomatoes. I don't want as many tomatoes. Or it's too many onions. Or not enough onions. You know, we have a few members who would get 4 bunches of kale a week in their box if they could. And some who never want any. And I mean, kale's a great example. When we do a survey, I think we'll just stop asking because half of the people say we want more and half of the people say...
Nobody says we're perfect.
Nobody says we're perfect. But it averages out to perfect. So that's, you know, it's like, it's part of, you know, it's part of the experience, you know. Try new things.
Yeah.
And strike a compromise. I think that the best, you know, excellence is doing our best to provide people with the resources and the means to make the most of it.
Yeah.
And, you know, the rest is up to them, and we can't do anything about that.
Yeah, I think communication is huge, just being honest about where we're coming from, mm-hmm. or, you know, if they're expecting more watermelons and we can't provide them, like, giving them a reason why so they feel... They understand and they're a part of the farm story too. I think the fact that we like to cook makes a difference too because we kind of know like what goes well together.
Mm-hmm.
And so I do try to like we grow baby ginger and so we try to you know grow lemongrass and eggplant and you know cilantro and have those all be in the same box together. Like I think that's kind of what makes an excellent CSA is giving people. A variety of, even if they're not familiar with it, would actually taste good together.
Is there anything that we didn't ask that you wanted to say?
I
I would say that we are still actively kind of growing sort of the cooperative farming model that's here on the ground. So now that it's up and going, we're certainly interested in other farmers joining and collaborating and sort of the potential there. So it's pretty awesome to have created sort of like what's in our vision and for the possibilities of the future, but it's certainly the beginning of that. So I don't know how many people who are also interested in that will see this, but I think that that's certainly a process that people should reach out if mm-hmm. they're also curious about mm-hmm. some of this stuff and want to live in awesome Jefferson, Wisconsin. Very awesome.
Anything to ask?
No. Thank you so much.
Cool, yeah.
This is awesome.
Thank you.
I mean, I could sit here and talk all day, but you have things to do.
You got some plumbers to deal with.
I do. I have a plumber.
All right. So, this is a script. This is the end of the interview Wednesday, January 28th. Interview with Dennis and Anne, Dadit and Erica. Thank you so much.
Thank you.